Hey, district leaders, I know you already know this. In schools worldwide, cell phones are posing real challenges on student engagement and mental well-being, and I want you to meet Yonder, a proud sponsor of an imperfect leader. And let me share this story from a visit I made to some schools in Silicon Valley. I asked some kids what they liked about Yonder, and after some funny looks, they shared that actually, with Yonder, teachers don't have to battle with them over phones anymore. In fact, one kid said to me he didn't have to worry anymore about his parents texting him in class, and the kid next to him like sort of shoved him and goes, "Texting? My mom used to FaceTime me in class." I want to introduce you to a support system that increases teaching and learning. I want you to discover why a million students choose Yonder daily. Minimize distractions, maximize learning potential. To learn more, go to overyonder.com. Y-O-N-D-R. Today on An Imperfect Leader, Sean Stewart is my guest. And because a major part of this podcast is reflecting on lessons learned, I was really excited to learn about Sean. He's not a superintendent, but I think school and district leaders can learn a great deal from him. He's an expert in historical leadership excellence and takes the lessons of the past into meaningful takeaways for today's leaders. His journey began in Chicago, and over the past 30 years, he's had the opportunity of traveling, sailing, and immersing himself in history and cultures. Sean, welcome to An Imperfect Leader.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here, Peter.
So Sean, when you and I began corresponding, I had actually just finished a book called First You Have to Row a Little Boat, Reflections on Life and Living by Richard Bode. And when I learned about you, I thought, man, Sean's wisdom aligns so well. You use artifacts from the world and across time to tell stories that connect all of us to a shared human experience. And I wonder, would you give us an example of what that looks like?
Sure. What I try and do when I try to get across to people is that although there are a lot of systems in place right now, you know, leadership principles and so on, the five steps to this and the eight secrets of that and all this kind of thing. In addition to that, you know, you can use from that what's useful to you. But what I really like to do is to go back to the basics and to say, okay, over the 100,000 years that modern humans have been walking around, we've pretty much seen all the problems already. And there are certain patterns that we can follow. And so what would it look like if we could choose a few sort of landmarks and sort of put them in our heads so that when we need them, and this is the key point for me, so when you need to access the leadership principle, the leadership lesson, you can do so immediately without having to think about all the theory and all the, you know, the academics that go behind. Just, oh, here's the one thing I need. Right? And that's actually something that Richard Bode talks about in the book that you mentioned. He talks about, if you remember, he talks about certain crises he had in his life. And then suddenly he remembered something. He remembered the bird that was perched on his mast. He remembered the fog that he was stuck in. It's sort of like that. It's just you remember one thing and that sort of unlocks the solution for you. So what if we just went back into the past and did that and accessed certain things? And the sort of the way I do that is to take historic artifacts and to present them to people. And when people are able to hold them, touch them, whatever they can do with them, the lessons tend to stick in their mind. And then I encourage them to put sort of artifacts that will do the same function for them in their office. So artifacts that are relevant to them. So you could buy a copy of what I have, or you could, you know, provide your own artifact. And one of the things that Bode talks about to answer your question is this notion of riding up on the wind, right? He talks about sailing to windward relatively early in the book, and he's holding on the tiller, and he opens the scene by saying, you know, he's fighting the tiller and he's panicking and he's thrusting this way and that with the steering device, the tiller, to try and get the boat to go where he wants it to go. And then he had his mentor come and told him, okay, actually, you know, the thing is that you just need to quiet down and feel what the boat's telling you. So I had actually known this from before because I grew up sailing like Richard did. And there is a groove. I didn't call it riding up on the wind. I called it the groove when I was there. And it is true. If you put your hand on the tiller very lightly, you can feel it. There's just a sort of a nice humming and you just get into it and the boat is doing what it should be doing. And so what I do is I bring in a tiller to the presentations, right? And the tiller is the object that they focus on. And what I tell them is very much what Richard tells them, which is that, you know, we talk about leadership as being this kind of robust activity, don't we? So it's chest thumping, it's sometimes chauvinistic, it's about getting your way, it's about winning, it's about crushing the opposition, it's about doing the right thing. But a key component of leadership is just listening, just being able to quiet down, quiet your mind, just listen to what the vessel is telling you, listen to what the crew is telling you, listen to what your team is telling you. And if you're able to listen for long enough, you also will get into the groove, right? So when the people hold the tiller in their hands, they can see this, they can visualize this. Aha, okay, now it sticks. Now, the interesting thing about the tiller is that just because you're listening to the boat or to your team doesn't mean you always have to do what they say. So if you see an obstacle in front of you don't just merrily plow on and say, oh, well, there's an obstacle. So just I'm listening to the boat. I'm not going to evade it. Of course, you push the tiller over and you take evasive action. You get people moving. But as a basic default position, that ability to sit quietly and listen is a sublime form of leadership. And that's what I hope will stick in their head. So when they come to this, crisis in the boardroom, maybe one of them will visualize the tiller and just calm and just
Right.
listen.
Yeah,
That's the
I
idea.
like that. That in terms of, I'm thinking about this artifact. I was thinking as you were describing, I mean, that's a real artifact in terms of using it as a metaphor for leadership. I imagine also as they're visioning and thinking about, what do they want to create together with their boards, with their teachers, with their principals. When we're thinking about a superintendent of schools with their community, an artifact might be one of these sort of like wooden traditional desks. And to sort of think about, the history of learning and schools and how they were put in rows in a very, Frederick Taylor way, right? To create very clear order and systems so that they could almost treat children as cogs to get them through so they could be productive in factories. And now we start to think differently about how we might use technology and how we might actually sit differently and how we collaborate. And that could be that sort of artifact that compels them to maybe start thinking differently about what they want and how they want to, what they want to create together. Does that resonate?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And I think that's one of the goals. I mean, if I could put my own two pennies in about the value of education is teaching people not to fulfill certain tasks. I mean, that's one part of education is to teach people to fulfill certain tasks. That's what they're going into. You have to do a certain thing and a certain things in a certain order to accomplish something. But on a deeper level, I think what we ought to be doing is to teach people to think for themselves, to be captains of their own vessels. Another thing that I really like about the whole sailing and nautical analogy and the maritime history metaphor, running along with this just came to my head now, is if you're talking about a squadron or a fleet, so let's say a racing fleet or a naval squadron or whatever it is, each individual vessel in that squadron is its own independent entity, right? But they're still acting in concert for a larger goal. So it's not an either-or question. You can still teach someone autonomy and thinking for themselves. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you're teaching them to just go ride roughshod over, whatever they want in the future. You're teaching teamwork through individuality.
I love to use the use of after-action reviews to help understand the past and really to make better future decisions. It's not something that superintendents do regularly, not because they're not interested, but typically they really don't have time, or at least they perceive they don't have time. And you do this with looking at historical leaders to help inform leaders today. How can knowing our history inspire better leadership decisions today?
One mistake people make when they talk about historical leadership is that they try and copy the past. One of the places we see this is with sports. We see Michael Jordan was one of the greatest basketball players of all time. And so if somebody wants to become like Michael Jordan, they're told to copy what he did, do what he did, do like Mike, and then you'll be there, right? The problem is it usually doesn't work out. So the solution isn't to copy what people did in the past. It's not to expect that history repeats itself. It's to use the experiences of the past as sort of, I like to call them like navigational beacons, like lighthouses, right? They don't tell you what to do, but they just tell you that basically here's where danger lies and here's where safety lies. So keep this point in mind, keep that point in mind as you navigate through. One of the lessons that I think is interesting for today's leaders, the film Napoleon comes into my mind because the film Napoleon is coming out, I guess in a couple of weeks' time, from when we're speaking now. And I suppose Napoleon's going to be all over the news because of this. And Napoleon gives us an interesting insight into the nature of leadership and historical leadership, because one of the assumptions that we make is that just because you are successful once, that means you're going to be successful all the time. And conversely, just because you failed once, that means you failed for all time. Napoleon was extraordinarily successful at
Yes.
what he did.
I'm thinking of the historical
Right.
perspective you may be about to share with me in terms of why Hitler then thought it would be appropriate to go into the Soviet Union, right? Napoleon didn't learned an
Yeah,
important
actually,
lesson.
one of the
You'd think
interesting
that
things
Hitler would
about
have
that, this is
too.
going off the this is going off the topic slightly, but one of the interesting commonalities between Napoleon and Hitler is they both invaded Russia on the same day, 22nd of June. And they both, one of the points that they had by doing that was to knock Britain out of the war in both cases, because Britain was one way or another relying on Russia. That's a whole other
Yeah, that's
long
interesting.
story to get into. But yeah. But anyway, what's interesting there is that they were successful up until Hitler was successful. Well, actually, Hitler and Napoleon were both successful up until they weren't. And there wasn't any massive sea change in what they were doing. Napoleon was the person he was. He was leading armies and conducting high-level, high-stakes diplomacy. And what worked before doesn't necessarily work again. That's one of the things to keep in mind. Another interesting point is that just because you're a successful leader in one sphere, people assume you'll be successful in every sphere, right? And we see this with one of the great Antarctic explorers, Shackleton, who was extraordinarily successful at rescuing his men from this perilous situation they had gotten into in the Antarctic. And he went through, all kinds of adventures over a period of, I forget exactly how long, a year and a half or something like that to save these people. And then here's the rub, when he tried to parlay that experience into other fields, into business, into politics, he basically failed. He just couldn't do it. He didn't have the skills to do it. So I think that's one of the interesting things that history teaches us, is just because you're successful once, and just because you failed once, doesn't mean you're going to fail again. And just because you're successful once, doesn't mean you're going to be successful always and everywhere.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, in particular, superintendents of school in public education often were reasonably successful, or if not exceedingly successful, teachers who became principals. And those principals, you might be in charge of a school of between 300 to 1,000 kids, in some instances larger. And then often you become the superintendent of tens of thousands of kids. And the leadership style, in terms of your interpersonal skills, those transfer. But the systems thinking piece is a new learned experience because you were sort of leading through relationship, and now you have to have very clear systems, and you have to say or think to yourself, what might be the unintended consequences of this decision? Or as I make this decision, how will I know I'm being successful? Am I, approaching success, or what are the markers for that? And just because you had past success does not sort of predict that you're going to have new success without learning some new skills. And I wonder, as you do this sort of historical look back, are there examples of those who may not have been initially successful, but then went and learned some really new important skills to be able to then make that mid-course correction that in the end they saw success?
I suppose you could say, in a manner of speaking, looking at somebody like Nelson, Horatio Nelson, the great British admiral. Here we have an example of somebody who was very successful at sea,
That's Nelson,
failed
right, in
miserably.
Trafalgar Square, who's sort of
That's
looking
the one,
out.
the very one.
Okay,
Yep.
yep.
And the reason he looks the way he does is because he was very successful at sea, but he was terrible on land. So he lost an eye and an arm on land, and so he's kind of carried his scars with him. I suppose what he learned is to stop forming operations on land and then, maintain this thing at sea. I think what you're saying is very interesting, though. Example, if we're talking about communications in the age of sail, is a random topic for you. How do you actually communicate with when you don't have radio? And so, if you look at the evolution of how that system evolved, it went from this sort of, very, stuttering and makeshift beginning, all the way up to this very fluent thing. But each iteration they went through, they had to consider, as you were suggesting, sort of the knock-on effects, what, because it's being taken away from personal control and it's being rendered into a system, a signaling system, which then has to be interpreted by people and interpreted by people in very precise ways. And that's very different from what was happening 100 years before, where systems were being, signals were being interpreted in very personal ways. So I know the admiral, I know the captain, I know what he really means when he said that. Versus, this is signal number 32. We're going to do this. Don't ask, just do. And that's what won Britain its empire, its naval empire, which is, I think, a compelling story. Although it's not a personal one, it's a sort of this sort of a systems history of systems work.
Yeah, no, but I think
Yeah.
that's really
So
interesting
yeah, that's quite
because
interesting.
so many of the decisions we make, particularly nowadays, you could almost take away that sometimes you can't totally understand what someone's saying over an email, for example. And so you interpret tone and you interpret what someone's saying, and you draw conclusions that sometimes are inaccurate. And so, the value of being able to speak face to face, and yet, in terms of your example, that wasn't always possible.
The Nelsonic solution to this problem was very simple. He gave a baseline. He said, look, if we ever fall out of communication, if you do this thing, I won't blame you afterwards. And his this thing in the case of naval warfare was his exact quote was, "No captain can do very wrong if he puts his ship alongside that of an enemy. So just get to grips with them and fight. Just shoot. That's it, right? That's so. Otherwise, listen for what I'm saying. But if that's not possible, do this, and you won't be wrong." So that baseline, they knew they had a baseline to fall back on.
Yeah, it's a default, right?
If
So
that
I
makes sense.
think in public education or education in general, public, private, whatever, that the default is do what's best for children. If we are not in communication and you have to make a decision, what is the best decision you can make for the lives of children in your care? Yeah. In my book and in the leadership model that I use to advise others, there's a dimension. It's called collective aspiration. And that's like the heart of an organization's work. And inside that dimension, there is a term, compelling purpose. And in order for a leader to answer the question, what do we want to create together? We must also look to our past to better inform our promising future. And you've stated people are drowning in modern guruism or blocked by endlessly complex leadership formulations. Yet all we need to know about effective leadership, which saves time and money and helps avoid painful mistakes, already exists. Would you give us an example of what you mean by this?
So when I look at the guruism that people are when I use that particular phrase, it's the idea that if you learn, and it's not ill-intentioned. I don't think it's ill-intentioned, but I think it just obscures people's understanding of what leadership consists of, right? And so I have plenty of stories in my arsenal of stories about, one guy that I don't remember the exact name, and not the names too clearly, but there's a system whereby you're assigned a color. Your personality is given a color. And so an individual I knew, she met one of the trainers here, and they started talking, he said, "Oh, you're a such and such a color." And she said, no, I tested out as something else." And he said, "Oh, that's strange, because people like you normally belong to this color." And I'm thinking, okay, that's not, the speed and the axis of that is not really ideal. So how can we cut through it? And what I've noticed is that if you look at successful leadership throughout time, you have three components. You have the character and personality of the leader. Crucially, you've got the character and personality of the team. And just as crucially, you've got the personality, so to speak, of the context. So leadership always depends on context. So what do people expect from you, right? And what they expect from you in situation one won't be the same as in situation number two. And I think we have to move away from the notion that there is a leadership model that works, as opposed to other leadership models which don't work. And we have to be very flexible in our thinking and to look at this as a thing that is happening in a certain context. For example, sticking with the theme of maritime history, since we're on topic of ships for this, we often hear modern leaders saying, don't use the stick too much, don't be harsh with your team. And yet, if you look at the early 18th century, when the notion of convoys were just coming into existence, the idea that merchant ships had to all sail together and be herded across a body of water to not be attacked. It happened to be the case that in one of the earlier wars in the 18th century, the naval captains that were assigned to guard the convoys more or less couldn't be bothered doing it. It was boring. They couldn't go off hunting, for rich prizes. And sure enough, the merchant fleet were picked off one by one. And one of these naval captains was put in prison for decades, which is an astonishing fate in that era where people were not put in prison for decades. Another one was fined a ridiculous amount of money. And the overall consensus was, that's great, deal with them harshly. And the rest of the naval fleet said, yes, we need this harsh discipline. We want this. We can't just be lax about this and say, oh, well, do it if you can, do it if you can. So the lesson that comes out of that episode is basically sometimes harsh leadership is what's expected in that context, the context being naval warfare where communication is bad and high stakes and so on and so forth. In other contexts, you will find that using the stick is a terrible strategy. So if you then tell people, use the stick or don't use the stick, never use the stick, always use the stick, it's pointless. So it's that idea that you read enough of these stories from our collective past, you start to see these patterns emerging, that it's leaders' personality, character of the team, and the character of the context. And you'll start to develop an instinct for what's right for you with your team in your context. And that will give you the solution rather than following a dogma, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm thinking particularly around schools and discipline practices, for example. And what we've learned, though, is that when we perpetually sort of suspend children for what we perceive to be disrespect or defiance, which is such a hard term to even define, that children miss, you know, huge amounts of learning time. And so then they're behind, and then it's this sort of cycle of behavior. So I kick you out, you come back further behind, you act up because you are embarrassed and behind and don't know what's happening. And so I kick you out again, and it's this like vicious cycle. And so leaders have to learn from those past experiences to sort of think about what might be a new way or a different path towards engaging a child in their learning while also demanding, you know, good behavior within the classroom, because it is, you know, 30 children in a classroom. You can't just have everybody doing whatever they want kind of thing.
Right.
And so I'm trying to put that in perspective in terms of the example that you gave, where it does, it all depends on context. And do you have a relationship with that child? Do you know that child's past and why they might be behaving in a certain way? And how do you intervene, not in that moment right there, but at some other time to find out, how can we work on this together? Because this is not working for either of us kind of thing.
One of the artifacts I bring in that sort of addresses this point is a mosaic of a laurel leaf. It's from Byzantine times, early Byzantine times. And, you know, laurel leaf is one of the symbols of victory. I say one of the things you can do when you're in these kind of complex situations where you've got to please the parents, you have to take the child into consideration, there's your goals, there's the goal of the school, of the institution, you've got all these potentially conflicting goals. Is to come back to the idea of this laurel leaf. So what are your terms of victory, right? What do you want to achieve in this context with this person? And focus on the ultimate victory. So if the ultimate victory is making sure the child doesn't fall behind at the very minute, right? Making sure they're engaged in the educational process, inspired by what they're learning. Let's say that's the ultimate dream. How then can you tack and jive your way up to that goal, right? And you can't do that successfully as a leader if you're just considering the leadership or the model. You have to consider the team, and you, in this case, the students, and the context. You know, is it, where's the school located? What kind of neighborhood is it? What kind of people are there? You know, all, you just get right down into the nitty gritty. Say, okay, now with all of that into consideration, instead of referring to the you know, the code, so to speak, the book of rules, okay, I'm going to be quite agile in my approach to this and keep my eye focused on the goal. What are my terms of victory for this whole thing?
Yeah, we call that in our model a shared image of success. Do we have a shared image of what we're trying to achieve?
Exactly.
And I love the metaphor of a mosaic, because, you know, each person in this story, in this context, is an individual with their hopes and dreams. But yet when we pull back out, we hope to see just the most magnificent and beautiful image that we created together. So I love the fact that you bring a mosaic of a laurel and the fact that it symbolizes victory. Oh, I may have to steal that from you.
it's a lovely image as well. Because no matter how you break down the metaphor, the individual tesserae, the tiles that go into the metaphor, they're all showing something different.
Right.
You know, they're different colors, they're different shapes, they fulfill it. But together, they all make the image. And you don't have to be like the next person. And that's an interesting lesson to teach the students, I would imagine, is that you don't have to be like this person or that. You just be you and be you well.
I love it. I'd like to ask you a question that I ask every guest who comes on the podcast. How does the term an imperfect leader resonate with you?
I think it's a central truth of leadership that there's no such thing as a perfect leader. As we were discussing a little bit before, it's extremely difficult for a leader to be successful consistently, even within their own profession. When they try and change from professions, they open up the chances for lack of success, for want of a better term. So an imperfect leader is really just somebody who has experienced a lack of success at some point and has reflected on it. And I think that's the key point for me, if I hear that term. They've reflected on why it didn't work, and then they've taken steps to change it and make it better. And it's really as simple as that. I mean, I wouldn't complicate it more than that. It's just that. And I think that if you have a leader who has experienced failure, they have reflected on it, and they have improved as a result, you now have a much more dependable leader.
My guest again today was Sean Stewart, a historian and a leadership expert. And I was trying to figure out a way to weave in Able I Was Ere I Saw Elba because of Napoleon, but from word and forward. But seriously, thank you so much for taking time.
Pleasure.
You're helping us think about how our past inform our present, and certainly how they inform our future. And this has really been so exciting. Thank you so much for your
time. Yeah, that was great fun, Peter. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Music for An Imperfect Leader was written and arranged by Ian Varley. Sam Falbo created our artwork, a wood print inspired Daruma doll butterfly. Remember, imperfect leadership is not a scarlet letter. It's a badge of honor. It recognizes that serving as a lead learner is about being a vulnerable leader, an empathetic leader, a compassionate leader. And I'm proud to be an imperfect leader. I'm Peter Stiepelman. Please join me next time for another episode of An Imperfect Leader, Leadership in After Action.